This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. It is a cruel reality of being an American farmer. You feed the nation and the world, but sometimes what happens a world away makes it hard to feed yourself or your family. Agriculture has been a major casualty of the U.S.-China trade war. Tariffs have closed off the world's largest commercial market to some growers across the country. But forget about President Trump and President Xi for just a minute. Forget about the political rhetoric and the double talk and the stock market and the people pulling the strings of the world economy. What's it like to be at the end of that string these days? Let's spend some time talking to farmers about what this trade dispute means for them and how they would like to see it resolved. We'd also love to hear from you, especially if your livelihood depends on the agricultural industry. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us by phone from Mecklenburg County, Virginia, is John Boyd Jr. He's a fourth-generation farmer and the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association. John, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also joining us by phone is Michelle Erickson-Jones. She's also a fourth-generation farmer in South Central Montana, and she's the former president of the Montana Grain Growers Association. Michelle, welcome.
Thanks for having me today.
I should note that we did invite the Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, to participate in this conversation. We got no response, but that invitation stands. Let's begin by getting to know the two of you a little bit, starting with you, Michelle. How long have you been a farmer, and what crops do you grow?
Well, I'm a fourth-generation farmer. I was born and raised on the farm that we farm now. I came back to farming full-time in 2012, though. So I've been on the farm ever since then. We raise wheat, barley, safflower, sunflowers, a little bit of corn, as well as alfalfa, and my husband and I have a small cow-calf operation.
John, what about you? What crops do you grow, and how long have you been in the business?
I've been farming since 1983, and we grow soybeans and wheat and corn. And this year, we're trying a hand at hemp for the first time. And we have 100 head of beef cattle.
John, tell me what an average day in your life is like.
Well, it's very hectic, believe it or not. So you got to get up early, and this time of year, we've finished planting the crops, and right now we're managing them.
And I'm sorry, you say you got to get up early. How early is early? What time?
I get up every day at 5 a.m. I'm out there at it.
So first thing
I do is check my livestock, and then off to check the crops and whatever else the day may bring in between.
Michelle, what about you? What's an average day like for you?
An average day for us is pretty similar to John, although I'm not quite as early of a riser as John is. But right now it's harvest season, so we've been cutting all of our wheat, and that makes definitely for some long, long, busy days. We're about done with that. And then we'll start looking at seeding next year's crop and starting all over again.
When we say long days, how long are we talking? 10 hours? 12 hours?
Oh, harvest time, certainly 10 to 12 easily.
And what about you, John? How long is a long day?
About the same. So 10 to 12 hours a day, easy, you know, easy. And, people need to understand, you know, farming is a little bit different than a day job, because things just come up, you know. You have equipment breakdowns and all kinds of challenges with Mother Nature, no rain, too much rain, all these things we have to deal with and kind of manage along through everyday lives.
Michelle, how have you been dealing with some of these things that just kind of come up, the unexpected? How's that been going lately?
Well, we just spent 2 days broken down with our combine, so... You know, there's been better weeks, but, you know, it just kind of comes with the territory, and we've gotten used to it, and you just make adjustments, and you don't quite finish harvest as early as you'd hope, but it still gets done, and we just work around any of those type of delays.
Now, how big an impact does that make, Michelle? 2 days without your combine to go harvest. Can you give me, you know, someone who's never worked on a farm, can you give me some perspective about how significant a backup that is? Is that the kind of thing you can just kind of be like, oh, it's just 2 days, we'll work around it? Or do 2 days make a big difference at harvest time?
It depends. It can make a huge difference. This year, the weather's good, so it's not going to make a difference at all. In 2014, for example, right at harvest in the middle of what is typically our harvest season, we got 3.5 inches of rain, and it ruined the crops. And on that year, it would have made a big difference. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of a difference. So it just varies like everything in agriculture. It's not a big deal for us this year, but it certainly could be.
So you got all kinds of internal factors that you got to deal with, the weather and equipment and any of the million and one things that can happen on a farm. We definitely want to talk to you about some of these external factors, namely the economic factors. 1A's Catherine Fink and Danielle Knight went to the Minnesota State Fair yesterday. We will be there tomorrow, take the whole show there. And outside the Farmers Union Hall that highlights the food grown by Minnesota farmers, we talked to the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. His name is Gary Wertish. Gary and his son grow soybeans, corn, and navy beans. And here's part of what Mr. Wertish told us. Listen.
The president's good at making announcements. He's not very good on following through. He's good at, you know, telling us we're winning when we're losing. Farmers are losing. Farmers are losing their farms. So farmers are getting tired of it. It's not a game. He's playing a game. It's like he's playing a game with us to try and make the bold statement. At the beginning of the trade issue, we all agreed that we need to look at China, but there needed to be a coalition of all countries working on it, not that together. And president's go-it-alone approach we felt was wrong right away, and it's proven to be wrong.
That's Gary Wertish, the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. Can I get your reactions to what he said there, Michelle, particularly because this trade war between the U.S. and China is not showing any signs of slowing down? What do you make of what Gary had to say?
I think he certainly hit on some important points that there's been a lot of back and forth that some of it, you know, certainly has been probably unnecessary. You know, there's certain announcements from the president that, you know, that China's going to buy all sorts of egg products, and then that doesn't come to fruition, and, you know, the market gets its hopes up or the farmers get their hopes up, and then it hasn't really worked out so far. And I certainly agree that, a coalition of the willing would have been a better approach to China, certainly for the U.S. to join TPP. That would have given us substantial influence in the Southeast Asian region, as well as joining
TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes, sorry.
Gotcha.
As well as, you know, joining other countries to work on China's trade distortions. The European Union is negotiating with China and has been since 2013, and that would have been a great ally to get some significant reforms that we're looking for in China.
John, what about you? Your thoughts on Gary's comments?
I think he's exactly right, and the president has to do better than what he's currently doing right now. He's hurting America's farmers, and when you take away the largest market for American soybean producers, it took a long time to open that door, you know, with China. And I'm by no means making these comments saying that I support any kind of politics that China has in their own country. All those things are their business. But I would like to see those doors open so farmers like myself could have a good market. And when you take away, 90% of the U.S. soybean market and not open up a door or, you know, with another partner, that's 90% of the world, we're basically 5% here in the United States. So 95% of the world has to be fed. We need to open up those type of trade avenues so that we can have a fair market. And when the president announced his plan, the billions of dollars to help farmers, anytime you have to depend on the United States Department of Agriculture and then come in and fill out all these paperwork and then they tell you, well, you know, you don't qualify on this end and you won't get these amount of money. You're only going to get this amount of money. That's not what we want. We want a fair market and a fair price for our commodity.
I do want to ask you more about that, particularly what the USDA has been doing. But I am curious how things stand financially, Michelle, with you right now. Do things seem kind of stable? Are they good? Do they look troublesome? What's it like financially right now, Michelle?
Well, we've been drawing break-even budgets for the last couple of years, and luckily we have gotten away with it, largely because we've had good crop years. But if you're going to make a break-even budget work because the export markets are roiled and there's excess supply in the world, then you certainly have to have high production, and that isn't always going to be the case. You know, we're not always going to get away with that. So there's certainly a lot of concern and a lot of stress, especially for a young farmer like myself, and especially for a wheat farmer like myself. We're not part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so we are risking our number one market in Japan, and we also have USMCA still up in the air, which is also a top wheat market for the United States and Mexico. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and certainly USMCA needs to be passed, but we've touched on so many of our major export markets that it's definitely getting harder and harder to have a break-even budget and make it.
Yeah, the USMCA, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the supposed successor to NAFTA, which is still kind of in process right now. We'll continue in just a minute, and John, I'd love to know what finances are like with your operation when we continue with John Boyd Jr., the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association, and Michelle Erickson-Jones, the former president of the Montana Grain Growers Association. Glad to get some of your questions and thoughts as well. We'll also zoom out a little bit to get the larger economic picture in terms of how various farms are doing. What's the future going to look like, and what do things look like for you policy-wise? If you're a farmer or a rancher or you work in agriculture, we'd love to hear from you. 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're discussing the state of farmers in the U.S. and whether some of the frustration might lead to eventual disillusionment with President Trump among some of his political base. We're speaking to John Boyd Jr., the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association, a fourth-generation farmer himself, and Michelle Erickson-Jones, also a fourth-generation farmer and the former president of the Montana Grain Growers Association. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let me get to a few of your comments before we keep going. Kim in Oklahoma writes, "We are cotton, peanut, wheat, corn, cattle, and horse ranchers. Trump's trade war is devastating our community. The uncertainty in the markets has totally stressed out our operation. We said it before the election, and we keep saying trade wars kill agriculture." Ian in Arkansas writes, "I work with farmers in Arkansas as collaborators in field research. Most of them grow primarily rice, but soybean is also a major crop in the area. These farmers are concerned with the tariffs, especially because of the additional impact of this past spring. Extremely wet conditions and several floods destroyed up to half of what some farmers were expecting to produce." Glad to hear your stories. We welcome more of them and just your questions about what happens from here on in. 1A@WAMU.org. John, let me pick up with you. What's the situation like on the ground for you, particularly economically? How do things look?
This has been one of the toughest years for a very long time for our farming operation. And right now I have 330 acres of soybeans in the ground. And this is the first year that I was not able to obtain a farm operating loan. And quite frankly, the bankers said they just couldn't see extending credit for grain prices, soybeans hovering around $8 a bushel. So this trade war is real, and it's affecting people, in this case, farmers, in a very personal way. And like I said, some of the program that the president touts about that and says continues to say that the farmers are doing great, and it's just not true. This is a very difficult time, and I can't see why this administration, from the president to the agriculture secretary, Sonny Perdue, they have a U.S. trade representative there. All those persons have failed to open up new markets for farmers like myself. And that's what this equates to. When you take away a person's market and not open up new trade paths for them to continue their farming operations, then you failed. And right now he's failed America's farmers.
I should note once more, we did invite the Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, to take part in this program. We got no response, but that offer certainly still stands. John, as the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association, what are you hearing from your members about how they're doing?
I'm hearing some of the same things that I'm sharing with you. Farmers want to know when this trade deal is, all these things are going to end. You know, how they can get credit. And more likely, they've been having a very tough time receiving their payments from the United States Department of Agriculture. In my own county, Mecklenburg County, Virginia, there seems to be a lot of confusion on how this year's payments will be rolled out. And they said 25% that you can sign up now for your acreage, and then another 25% after harvest. And then they said if they continue the program, they would extend the rest. So it's too much uncertainty. And farmers can't plan like that. I have basically two paydays a year. You know, when I sell my winter wheat and when I sell my soybeans in the fall, and in between there, I'm a cattle farmer, so I kind of sell my calves there in between when I need some money. So we can't afford to have a missed payday here. And that's what this administration is doing when you have so much uncertainty out there. It's hard for farmers to plan.
I do want to talk more about what the administration is doing in one second, but with regards to the payouts, Michelle, I wonder if you can answer a question just in terms of the economics of farming from Kit, who asked, aren't most farmers millionaires many times over, owning hundreds or thousands of acres of land? I know that is the case in central Indiana, where I grew up and still live part of the time. Michelle, what would you say to Kit?
You know, certainly most farmers are not millionaires by any stretch of the imagination. And a lot of that land, you know, obviously we pay mortgages on it. We are landowners. We're not millionaires by any means, but we are landowners, but we're still paying for that land. And, you know, more importantly than that, I mean, yes, you can sell off land, but, you know, there's still operating costs every year. There's still, you know, you still have to break even on what that you have. Land is a fixed cost. It's just like owning a house. It's not, you know, it's not obviously something that you're going to use to pay a fertilizer bill or something like that. So it's most farmers are not millionaires. That would be the most important point, but it's just one of those, it's a little bit more difficult to understand, you know, outside of farming, that liquidity and availability of cash can be a significant issue. And that is the biggest issue right now is, you know, cash on hand and eroding liquidity and eroding net farm income.
So you may have assets that are worth a million or so, but the cost may be high, or if you can't get money to fill gaps, then you have a larger problem. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's saying you have assets worth a million. That is still rare in agriculture, and quite honestly, a lot of that land could be leased. You know, it's not the farmer that owns it. But it's still, land is going to be your biggest asset for the most part if you happen to own it, but it's still not, you know, it's not a liquid asset.
John, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wanting to say, and she answered the question very well. I'm by no means a millionaire, but we own land. But just like she said, I have a mortgage. And for the caller or writer that wrote that, it's almost like you having a $100,000 a year job, and your boss comes in today and says, hey, you're going to have to do the same job with 50% pay reduction. That's what farmers are being. That's the card that we're being dealt with right now. So these prices are some of the lowest prices for cost per acre to operate than I've seen in decades. I don't know how we're going to stay on the farm with $8 a bushel of soybeans. So that's these people need to understand.
I did want to ask about that a little bit, Michelle, because, you know, we've heard that farm bankruptcies have been trending up. The American Farm Bureau tracks that. Some states have seen an increase of 50% or more in farm bankruptcies. Congress passed this farm bill to deliver $867 billion to struggling farmers. Michelle, how much, if at all, of that money have you seen come into your community? And if that money has come in, have you seen any benefits?
Well, the farm bill is structured, you know, a lot of it is risk management. the big chunk of it, well, first of all, the big chunk of it is nutrition, and so that does not necessarily impact farmers. The much smaller portion of it is for the farm, is for farm programs specifically, and they, the big bulk of it is crop insurance. And crop insurance, really, it has a revenue component, but it does not protect against this trade war by any stretch of the imagination. So for someone like myself, I still may be barely breaking even, but we've had high enough yields that I'm not going to get a crop insurance payment at all. I'm just going to pay into the crop insurance system like we do every year. And so that's a big portion of it. The farm bill is not designed to be disaster assistance. It's not designed to be ad hoc disaster aid, which trade aid is technically considered disaster aid. It's, we've designed it so that it is WTO compliant and so that it functions as a safety net, but it's really not designed to function as a safety net for a large-scale, multi-fronted trade war. So technically, there's not a lot of that that flows into our community outside of conservation payments that we already would have had and some of the commodity payments, but they're just, those would have always been there, and so they're not substantial amounts of funds.
I want to add one more voice to our conversation and get to some more of your comments and shift gears a little bit to the politics of this, because, of course, you know, President Trump has counted many farmers and many people in the heartland within his base of support. That support from some of you, from just some of what you've sent us today, is wearing thin as this trade war continues. Joining us from NPR in Washington is Alan Rappaport. He's an economic policy reporter for The New York Times. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I got these contrasting comments from listeners, from farmers, both fourth-generation farmers. I don't know how we cornered the market on fourth-generation farmers today, but we got a bunch today, with contrasting points of view on President Trump. Before I read those, what have you seen in your reporting in terms of the changing support for President Trump among the agriculture communities of the country?
Well, we've been hearing that he still has strong support. It's not like we're about to sort of see a blue wave just yet in the agricultural world, but we do see signs that that support is starting to diminish and that patience is wearing thin, sort of both anecdotally and in some of the polling. There was some polls of the agriculture community in July and August. We saw his support drop from 79% to 71%. And it seems like August actually, you know, has been sort of a pivotal turning point where the frustration has started to come to a head.
Agriculture Secretary Perdue has been hearing some of that frustration. He's been traveling, speaking to farmers. As I understand it, some of his speaking engagements haven't been met really that well. But what's the overall plan to reach out and how has that been going?
So he's been to all 50 states. He's traveled, you know, over 100,000 miles. He's made a real effort to, you know, be on the ground, visiting farms, visiting agricultural communities to try and get the administration's message across, as well as to, you know, bring messages from farmers back to the White House. You know, we did see most notably he took a fair amount of flack at the Farm Fest convention in Minnesota earlier this month, where he got a lot of pointed questions from farmers about, you know, when is the trade war going to end? When are the tariffs going to be over? And what are you going to do about this? And there was, it seems like there started to be the sense, you know, from farmers that the administration was not really feeling their pain. And you know, notably, there were some actually some boos in the room when he made a joke about, you know, farmers' tendency to whine, and that caught some attention.
I think the joke was something like, what do you call two farmers that are trapped in a closet? The answer is a wine cellar. I don't think they like that very much, Alan, if I'm getting the joke right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was intended to be humorous, but just having spoken to people who were in the room, I think there's a lot more sensitivity right now to the fact that this isn't really a laughing matter anymore.
John Boyd, you've met with Secretary Perdue recently. What was your take on your conversation with him?
Well, I've actually had met with every secretary, agriculture secretary, since the Carter administration, both Republican and Democrat. And the meeting with Secretary Perdue was the worst meeting that I've had with any agriculture secretary. And we spoke about increasing black and other minority participation on commissions there at the United States Department of Agriculture. I asked him about increasing minority employees in local county offices. In my own personal office, county office in Mecklenburg County, Virginia, There isn't a person of color that works there, and I would like to see those numbers change. And his response was, well, you know, he didn't see a need for any tokens. And he used the word token, and I thought it was very offensive. And the conversation went downhill from there. So it was the worst meeting I ever had with a sitting agriculture secretary. And like I said, I met with them all, from Ann Veneman to Dan Glickman to Mike Espy, and the list goes on and on. And that was the worst meeting I've ever had.
Let me get to some of your comments with regard particularly to your support or lack thereof of President Trump. Both of these comments, by the way, I should note, come from fourth-generation farmers. Sandra writes, fourth-generation farmer here from central Kansas. Farming is like no other lifestyle that I can think of. We're always at the mercy of the weather, the markets, and countless other variables we have no control over. We stand behind President Trump's trade war with China. They have manipulated markets for years with no consequences. We are suffering willingly, financially, in hopes to bring about a more fair playing field. Contrast that with what Mike wrote. Mike writes, fourth generation farmer in West Central Ohio. I farm with my two brothers and mom. We're soybeans and corn. We were Trump supporters. He lost all of us when he insinuated we were soldiers in his trade war against China. My daughter, nieces, and nephews are not soldiers, but are suffering too. They're noticing that we are now struggling. We also just got hit hard by new EPA rulings on ethanol use. It may kill this American farm. And I believe Mike is referring to EPA changes in terms of the balance of ethanol that goes in gasoline that you and I buy at the gas pumps. Michelle Erickson-Jones, what is your sense from where you sit of the political impact of this trade war? Do you think that the farmers in your area are more supportive, less supportive, as supportive? How do you see it?
You know, it's one of those things that I really tend not to ask, and only because I work in nonpartisan politics and, you know, I want to be able to walk into any office in Washington, D.C. and have conversations with any of them. So I stay out of the partisan politics as much as I can. You know, it's certainly difficult, and this trade war is certainly very frustrating. And, you know, I will certainly tell the president that if I ever, you know, ever got to have a meeting with him, how damaging it has been, but focused, you know, strictly on the policy. But I, you know, these economic conditions, I'm not going to say they're going to move voters by any means. Voting is complex, but certainly the economic conditions are going to weigh on agriculture.
John, how do you see it?
I believe that we need a change, and I think that this administration has failed America's farmers. And like the caller or the writer said, that they were suffering willingly. I really don't want to suffer willingly. I would like to see a fix to the situation. And I also haven't heard any of the Democratic candidates on the other side of the fence say how they would handle this if they were president, and how they would bring the trade war to the end to help America's farmers. And I would like to also say, the problem that's going on with farmers right now isn't Republican or Democrat. The problem is income. And when you don't have the income to pay your mortgage at the end of harvest, you either wind up in bankruptcy or you wind up on the auction block. That's the reality of the situation.
I do have one or two more questions to ask the two of you before we let you go. We'll continue in just a minute with John Boyd Jr., Michelle Erickson-Jones, and Alan Rappaport of the New York Times. Also want to talk larger trade issues. Harry emailed, I don't care if farmers can't sell soybeans, radishes, or pork bellies to China. I'm not in the export business. I want a strong U.S. dollar and fines and fees imposed on other countries who try to cheat America, the first, middle, and last buyer of everything on Earth. Could this all be worth it if it improves our trade policy? We'll consider that next. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Alan Rappaport of the New York Times and Michelle Erickson-Jones and John Boy Jr., both fourth-generation farmers. I want to add another voice to the conversation, and we really appreciate the two of you sharing your stories with us about what's been going on in your farms and your businesses. Thanks to all of you who've shared your stories with us. We've still got time for a few more, so feel free to send them in, 1a@wamu.org. I'm just kind of curious from both your perspectives, John and Michelle, what's the number one thing right now that the administration, that the USDA could be doing to help the two of you individually in terms of what your farm operations need? Michelle, let me start with you. If there's one big request that you would make of the administration to help you out, what would it be?
Well, number one is to pass the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, to send that to Congress and get it through and passed and ratified into law. That is essential for stabilizing, you know, our number two and number three total markets, Mexico and Canada, as well as either rejoining the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been renamed the CPTPP, or finalizing this bilateral agreement with Japan. That's an essential market for wheat, beef, corn as well. And so giving us stable access to those markets while we continue to deal with China would be, you know, a big step forward, preferably rejoining TPP, because that gives us access to 11 countries as opposed to just Japan, which have some other important strategic markets, including Vietnam and Malaysia. And so there's certainly, you know, obviously no shortage of trade requests that I have of the administration, but that would certainly be the big one, to give us that increased market access and give us new markets to go to while we focus on China.
And before I come to you, John, Michelle, since you mentioned the USMCA, do you consider that to be a significant improvement over NAFTA?
It's not a significant improvement necessarily, but it has important improvements. For the wheat industry, it has a key change to how Canada accepts wheat into that country. And we don't send a lot up there necessarily, but for a border state such as ourselves, it is an important improvement, so that they are graded on the same level. They're considered equal quality, whereas they were not before. And it also has some important updated phytosanitary, which is food safety regulations that weren't in the old NAFTA. I mean, NAFTA was old. It definitely needed some updates into modern technology, biotech, that sort of thing. So there's been some important improvements. But more than anything, it just is important to stabilize those markets and to give us that market access that we've come to depend on. Mexico is a top importer of wheat. They're a number one exporter of barley. And so it's just an essential market.
And John, before we let you go, what's the number one thing the administration could do to help you right now?
It's open up all of its programs to small-scale farmers, African-American farmers. The payout in the TPP program has been too slow to reach Native farmers, and in this case, especially Black farmers, who were pretty much totally absent from the payout. And that could be improved dramatically with technical assistance and outreach that this administration has turned a blind eye to.
John Boy Jr., the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association and a fourth-generation farmer. John, we really appreciate you making time. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And Michelle Erickson-Jones, also a fourth-generation farmer and the former president of the Montana Grain Growers Association. Michelle, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll continue our conversation now with Alan Rappaport of the New York Times, and also to help us think about this more broadly, from an international trade perspective, we're joined now by Chad Bown. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank focused on the international economy. Chad, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder, Chad, if maybe we start with that comment that I read a minute ago from Harry, who writes, "I don't care if farmers can't sell soybeans, radishes, or pork bellies to China. I'm not in the export business. I want a strong U.S. dollar and fines and fees imposed on other countries who try to cheat America, the first, middle, and last buyer of everything on Earth." Chad, what do you make of that comment?
Well, it's hard to make sense of that comment. I think one of the things that I've learned listening to the farmers today, and I was in Iowa 3 weeks ago and spoke to a number as well, is the situation facing farmers right now is challenging, but it's also very, very different depending on, you know, what crop you're in, whether you're in soybeans or corn or wheat or barley or cattle. And I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, I'm not interested in exporting, because for some of those folks, that's their entire livelihood. You know, they sell most of their products overseas. There isn't sufficient American demand for what it is that they do. And they have been successful at that. They built their businesses around that economic model. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's kind of hard to make sense out of what that comment is trying to get at.
Well, and I'm not sure we can even tease those things apart per se to say I don't care about farmers exporting, I just want a strong U.S. dollar. Those things are kind of locked together, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing that we should say is that if you have a very strong U.S. dollar, which of course is not what the president wants right now. He wants a weaker dollar, right? It makes it easier for Americans to sell their products overseas. A strong dollar makes imports coming in from China or from Mexico or other countries cheaper and makes it more difficult for American industries to compete, American farmers to compete in the American market. So that's not the traditional response, at least certainly by this administration and many American policymakers.
Chad, let me play one more clip from Gary Werdish, the president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. We spoke to him yesterday at the Minnesota State Fair. Listen.
This is a long-term problem, and the president really destroyed that China market rule. And the farmers spent their tax, their commodity dollars building those markets up, building those trade relationships, and the president took that away from us. And now, you know, that's where we lost our relationship as a reliable trading partner. But at the same time, it's going to take decades to build them back, even if the trade war ends tomorrow.
Chad, what about Mr. Werdish's comment that it would take decades to fix the damage from this trade war, even if it ended tomorrow?
I think he's exactly right. And in some respects, it may now be unfixable. You know, I think China now looks quite skeptically at the Americans, at us, and is saying, well, you know, how reliable is the United States as a trading partner? We should look for other sources for products like soybeans. And so over the last year, they've increasingly bought soybeans instead from, you know, countries like Brazil and Argentina. Those countries are helping to develop their own infrastructure to be able to plant more, to be able to get their crops to China. And once those countries have replaced the American soybean exports with their product instead, China may never come back. I think there's evidence of that taking place historically, and that may be especially true this time around, given you know, the new levels of tensions between these two countries.
Bill writes, I'm a farmer and rancher from Bluff City, Kansas. Here, people are suffering quietly under a sort of culturally instinctive desire to support the president, although none of them knows what it is exactly we, let alone he, want from the Chinese. Rebuild our steel mills? Buy more video games? Would somebody please articulate what the goals are and why they couldn't have been pursued through the World Trade Organization with our allies? Chad, what about that? What were the goals and why couldn't they have been pursued other ways?
Listen, I think Bill has it exactly right. For those of us whose job is entirely to try to figure out what it is that this administration is seeking as an end game with the trade war of China, we're still very much up in the air. The president sometimes talks about it's about fixing the trade imbalance, the trade deficit with China. There are serious concerns with China or challenges with China. It is not a market economy. It has a lot of subsidies. They don't protect intellectual property in ways that we would prefer them to be able to do. Some of that is just a different structure of how they run things. Some of it is they're still, you know, a developing country. They're not as poor, they're not as rich as we are in the United States, and so they have different priorities. But I think putting all of that aside, the president really hasn't made clear what the purpose and what a satisfactory end result of this trade war might be. And so I think all of us now don't know, are we any closer to resolving this thing? Is there really a resolution in sight? Or is the new normal, this new world with lots and lots of tariffs and American farmers no longer having access to the Chinese market?
Alan, this comment comes up quite a bit, and Pat wrote it in a message to us. Pat writes, I am a retired farmer, currently a landlord and a part-time employee of my tenant. farming operation located in west central Indiana. Corn and soybeans are the major crops. We are affected substantially by the loss of the Chinese market for beans and related products, as are our neighbors. Despite this, most support the actions against China. This is long overdue. It should have been dealt with during the Obama, Bush 2, Clinton, and Bush 1 administrations at the very least. Now we have to pay the price for past inaction. Alan, that point comes up quite a bit, including from the president, that he's doing something that Barack Obama should have done, that both Bush presidents should have done, that Bill Clinton should have done. They left this problem for too long, and now I'm going to fix it. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I think that that person definitely is sort of echoing, you know, President Trump's comments pretty much directly. And it sounds like, you know, that's what you do hear from the sort of core supporters of the president and from the heart of his base. You know, I think there is widespread agreement that China has been a bad actor on trade for a long time. I think one of the main areas of disagreement is whether or not, you know, President Trump and his tactics and his strategy are the best way to go about sort of bringing them around and correcting these problems. I think from Democrats you hear a lot more, on the one hand, they agree with the end that President Trump is trying to achieve, but they're basically making the point that he's sort of blundering it and fumbling it and, you know, hasn't really come with a clear strategy for winning and solving this problem.
Chad, how would you respond to that? Is that true that previous administrations had a chance to resolve this, should have resolved it, knew they should have resolved it, and just didn't? Is that true?
Well, I would take a slightly different view. I think, there was a sense when China came into the World Trade Organization, you know, almost 20 or so years ago, that it was on a much different path, a much different trajectory that it's on now. It was becoming more market-oriented. It was becoming more like us. And, you know, the history coming out of the 1990s is when countries in Eastern Europe moved away from communism. They just sort of naturally fell in line with our model. And I think there probably was an excessive optimism that China would just do that. It hasn't turned out to be the case. But there's also been significant reversals in terms of how China has operated in the last 4 or 5 years that have made things even more challenging today. So, I mean, I do think some of what we're seeing the Trump administration take on would have had to have been taken on by whoever the current president is, you know, even if somebody different had won back in 2016. So some of these problems, I think, some of them are longstanding, but I think some of them are very new.
Sarah writes, I am shocked by the comments by non-agriculture listeners. Do they not realize that we feed the world, and that includes the United States, that the current administration has taken away our ability to make a living? With the push for farm-to-table produce, who's going to produce the fresh produce? Tyson? Cargill? Land O'Lakes or corporate farms? I think not. The family or little farmers are the lifeblood of the economy for small-town America. We are losing more than markets. We are losing a way of life. Alan is a longtime grain farmer from southeastern Illinois. Here's what Alan left in our inbox.
Been farming for 44 years, farm several thousand acres. And right now in agriculture, it's really tough. It's hard to, with all the equipment, combine, both heads, you're looking at $600,000 to $700,000. Tractors, anywhere from $200,000 to $400,000. And honestly, it's tough. Nobody can afford them. You know, farmers are very resilient. We struggle through, but right now with our market out of China, makes it real tough.
Yeah, Alan, I really appreciate you sharing your story. Thanks for talking to us. But Alan Rappaport, as we kind of look forward politically to where this goes, I got to say there's lots of people who have kind of zero sympathy for agricultural America, which, as we've said, has a strong base of support for President Trump. Brett tweeted, how many of these farmers voted for Trump? They did it to themselves. Alan, what about that?
Well, I mean, I think you hear that a lot, and there's often a lot of concern and questions about why people sometimes vote against their interests. And I think, you know, we'll see what happens next time around. I spoke to a farmer who I quoted in the story, who said that he wouldn't vote for President Trump in 2020 after what's happened. He doesn't feel like he's handled this trade situation well enough. And I think you're going to hear a lot more of Democrats trying to address what's been going on with the rural economy and, you know, the sort of the divergence and the inequality with what's been happening with the rest of the economy to try and peel some of those voters away. It's not necessarily, you know, the hugest block of voters in the United States, but, you know, they are very important and they are in key states, and it's going to be a close election. So I think there's going to be a lot of focus on the fortunes of these people.
And Hugh writes, I'm in the sixth generation of farming in the central Illinois county, following many generations before that. Farmers have the most to gain from fair trade with China, which should have been strongly promoted for many decades before now. Chinese consumers would benefit from fair trade, as would this nation as a whole. I am loyal to efforts to make this happen. Chad, as we're winding down, what would you say is the one biggest thing that could be done right now by the administration, either current or what may come in 2021, to try to ease the sting of this for America's farmers? Before we go, where's the most good to be done right now?
Well, I think it's highly unrealistic, but I think, you know, removing all of the tariffs that have been imposed, all of the ones that are coming on over the next 3 months, you know, I think that would convince China to get rid of its trade barriers and to reopen some of its markets for agricultural products. I'm not optimistic that that's going to happen. And so if that's not going to happen, then, you know, doing what the administration is doing elsewhere, trying to keep open other markets like Japan, like Mexico and Canada with the USMCA agreement, as Michelle mentioned, all of those things are important. It's not just China. It's the fact that the administration hasn't been engaged on trade policy in other markets as well. And so those are now at risk.
Chad Bown, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Chad, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And Alan Rappaport, economic policy reporter for The New York Times. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Today's conversation was produced by Morgan Givens with help from Danielle Knight and Catherine Fink. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Thanks to Minnesota Public Radio for helping us this week as we broadcast from the Twin Cities. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow from the Minnesota State Fair. This is 1A.